Welcome to another episode of Elaine's Literary Salon podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey James Higgins. I'm a suspense and thriller writer, and my wife, Cynthia, and I own Elaine's Literary Salon and Elaine's Restaurant in Alexandria, Virginia. We've turned it into a literary hub in the Washington, D.C. area. Our podcast, elainesliterarysalon.com, has reached people all over the world. So I'm really excited about this. I believe today is our 179th interview, and I'm excited for our debut author today. Yeah, that is a wow. It's a lot.
That is a wow number.
So Chandrani Ghosh is a former journalist who worked at Time, Forbes, and Business Standard. Drawing on her experiences of growing up in the chaotic worlds of Calcutta and Delhi, spending her 20s in London, Geneva, and Kathmandu, and eventually settling in Washington, D.C., she makes her literary debut with Heartlines. Chandrani, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon podcast.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
It's a really big deal, by the way, a debut. You know, it's I've mentioned this with some other writers, but writing is one of the weird art forms where everyone thinks they can do it and plan to do it. It's like around 90% of people say they have a book in them someday. But then when they actually start to write, only like 3% of them ever begin and only 1% ever finish. Like, it's incredibly difficult. So congratulations on bringing a book across the finish line. Huge, huge effort.
Wow, Jeff, I didn't know those numbers, and those are pretty, okay, I feel happier about myself. You just already made me feel good.
And even the publishing chances are way lower, and then publishing with like a big five or traditional publisher are even lower than that. So you're in a very small minority. So tell us about Heartlines without giving up the ending. Give us a little back jacket copy.
Sure. So it's a contemporary love story set in Washington, D.C.'s sort of affluent Indian American community. It's set at the nexus of media, politics, and the high-tech world. And when the book begins, my main character, Indian American political journalist, lives with her boyfriend, who is Lionel Stern, a Washington born and bred television anchor. They're the ultimate DC power couple, living in Georgetown. And into this seemingly picture perfect life comes two things. One, a chance encounter with an interesting tech entrepreneur, a charismatic one. And then something from Sharmila's past is sort of threatening to hit the headlines. And so the way I see it, you know, love stories are complicated, love triangles more so. And then you throw in the sort of intrigue and scandal of a Washington story, and you've got my book.
It sounds fantastic, and the writing's really good. And I love how you have, like, you know, like the family secret too. Like, you're hitting a lot of these major tropes or story points, right, that draw readers in. It has obviously the romantic element, and that's one of the love triangles, a big romantic subgenre. What are the main genres that you have this in? Because I've seen it listed as literary fiction. What in your mind? You're the author. You tell us, where should this sit?
Yeah, you know, I've actually had a hard time with where it should sit, because I was my publisher saw it initially as a straight up romance, but then with the reaction of the readers over the last month, because it came out first in India, and then I was in the UK, and then I came here, right? So it's been out for a month already. And I think what's been really wonderful and surprising is just the wide range, which normally a romance book would not. So even though it's this pink cover, and it's a very attractive cover that they put together, it's not in any way a traditional romance. In my head, a traditional romance has some very, like, you know, like it's a two character book in some ways. This is so not that. There's not just the three of them, like the love triangle, but this whole community of people that is play a significant role, like, you know. And so to me, it's a much bigger book. It's more layered than a regular romance would be, which is why I know a couple of reviewers called it a literary romance. And I guess that was a way for them to try to move it out into somewhere else. There's also the whole political intrigue part of it, which is, again, not a traditional romance, often would not have that. So anyway, so I guess I think it will be it's a good beach read in the sense that it's fast paced and moves well. But apart from that, I hope that it hits a broader section than just traditional romance.
I talk to a lot of readers here at the Literary Salon, mm-hmm. and what I find with when I talk to them, a lot of them, you know, regardless men, women, they people who like romance, people who read thrillers, they all tend to read a lot of different things. Do you think like this whole genre thing is sort of a holdover from the bookstore shelving, like, you know, mechanism? Like, because it sounds like you say they call it literary, right, to like try to reach a broader audience. But right. I mean, literary to me, I don't even know what literary means. I mean, I know it when I see it. You know what I mean? Is it elevated prose? Is it elevated concepts? What does it mean to you when someone calls this literary fiction?
I took it as, let's just say, I took it as a compliment. I was happy with it because I felt like they were trying to say that this was a more layered, nuanced book than a traditional, a trope-driven romance. And I think, Jeffrey, if I think of the way I wrote this book, it makes sense that, and I'm glad that the reviewers and the readers are picking up on it. I really didn't have a type of, like, I didn't sit there and say, I'm writing a romance. I actually just started writing what I thought were characters. These were just, it was so character driven. It was very organic. I knew at some point she was going to maybe meet a man, you know, like there was something else going to happen, but I didn't know who she was going to end up with. You know, it's a love triangle. It wasn't, it was really a character driven book that just went where it went. And eventually I did have to go back and do a lot of rewriting as a result to make the, you know, narrative arc flow well. So maybe it wasn't the most efficient way to write a book, but I think it makes it much more authentic and organic because that's how it came about. Like I, during COVID, started writing this book, you know, and I was just writing these interesting characters. This Mrs. Jhunjhunwala is a character that I thought was really interesting to me, like somebody who, you know, is at some level very traditional and yet very much a successful woman of the world and understands what goes into that. So I wanted this interesting matriarchal figure who was not in any ways, like, even though the stereotypes were there, they were not all of her and they didn't explain her. And so she was someone who was in my head long before, in fact, Sharmila was. and so I wrote it really, I wrote her character, I wrote Sharmila's, I brought in, you know, and then that's how the story just began.
I think that's really important as a writer, writing that story and developing the characters and not being driven maybe by when you're starting by market forces or by any other expectations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that character too, right from the early pages, this might be why they call it literary, because you have some strong, like, even the way they reference each other, right? The strong in the language and the dialogue and the way they're thinking about each other, that is elevated, you know, like the full character comes out in just these little details. And you don't see that as often in writing.
Right. Well, I hope that's true. I mean, I've got really, really positive feedback for 5 weeks that I've been meeting people and it's been just, I've been blown away. Like, again, as I said, wasn't just young women reading it by any chance. There was a lot of men read it, which was lovely. A lot of women in their 50s, 60s. I've been very, very, you know, like really. And I've had a lot of people write to me saying, oh, I was like, you know, I couldn't put it down. I finished the whole thing, which is, as you know, as a writer and definitely as a first-time debut writer, the joy I get when I wake up to these texts, and especially because it's all over the world. So I often it's like when I wake up in the morning and I look at my, you know, both social media as well as just texts coming through and people just writing, you know, the joy they got out of it, that it was something that was, yeah, that I think that's maybe my journalism background too, the pacing of the book. In some ways, there's no dropping off. There's no lull in the book. It moves. At least that's what I like to think. And I hope you felt that way too.
So you have, like, from the journals, you've had people reading your work before. How is it different when they're reading your fiction? Because fiction is so personal, right? This is your imagination. It's coming out of your head. Like, when did you have any apprehension? Like when the book first came out and now you have strangers, these aren't beta readers or friends and family, right? These are people from around the world reading your book. What, tell us about that feeling.
Oh, I was definitely really tense going into it. Like, you know, and I was really worried. And all I wanted was, okay, at least I hope a few people like it. My bar, luckily, was very low on this. And so I have to say it was joyful to realize the other way around. Like when the first really glowing review came through, I'm like, okay, I should cherish this because this might be the only really, like, I don't know why this woman took such pains to read it so well. And, you know, and she really... she picked up on all the layers. And I thought that that was rare. Like, you know, I thought, oh, other people aren't going to. I'm just lucky that the first reviewer who did an official review read it with such care. But since then, I mean, I can't tell you how many people, like, I was in London last week and there was a Turkish lady who had read it. In fact, she'd ordered it on her way back from, you know, whatever. And she had, like, underlined and, you know, had little, and she wanted to tell me the places where it crossed the cultural, like, even though my main characters are, not everyone, but two out of the three are Indian American. The other person is a Jewish man. And, you know, but this Turkish lady found so much that she could really relate to in that immigrant experience part of it. It was wonderful to see her having underlined and read back to me things like, oh my God, when you said this, that really resonated. And so I have to say, my bar was low, my expectations, I was very worried. And so far, 5 weeks in, it's been sheer joy. I don't know if I'm ever going to have five more weeks of life that are going to be this joyful. So I'm definitely riding a high.
That's it. Oh, keep riding as long as you can. That's wonderful.
I know. I mean, yeah.
This is the best part, right? This is the cool part, because you do everything in isolation and now you're out in the world getting feedback. I wonder where the fear comes from, like when you first publish something, though, because you wrote it, you enjoyed it, right? It's a story you created, but if you enjoyed it, and I tell writers this all the time, like if it's something that you're interested in, there's a readership for it, right? Other people will be. Yeah, we're all kind of scared when the book comes out. You're waiting for people, or and I've talked to, you know, number one New York Times bestsellers who have 20 bestsellers out, and they're really, every time they publish a book, they're thinking, oh, this is the one that will end my career. This is the one where people will discover I'm a fraud, right? That imposter syndrome.
Do you
experience any of that? Do you know why? Like, why would we have that? You know what I mean? It doesn't really make sense when you think about it.
That's true. But I do, the imposter syndrome, 100%, have felt it I keep waking up thinking, oh, it's somehow people are going to find out. It's not, but what's not real? Like, I wrote this book. It's a book but somehow there's a feeling that it's not really, do I have, even these conversations where you're asking me things, I'm like, do people really want to, you know, do I have a right to even talk about these in such detail? And like, you know, and so the joy of finding not just readers, but also listeners, like I've had so many book events this past month, and to have room full of people listen, then ask me such fantastic, thoughtful questions, and really just been very, totally. You're right on the imposter syndrome. I feel it continuously, and I keep thinking I'm going to somehow get caught in doing what I don't know.
No, I think writers want to hear the details because we all go through it, and you really are writing alone. You have an agent, you have a publisher, right? But for the most part, you're just by yourself. And so when they hear that everybody else is going through the same thing, especially writers that they really respect and writing that they like, I think it makes them feel better. And for readers, this is why reading is so different. The story that they're seeing in their mind is not the one you saw when you wrote this, right? It's a uniquely personal experience for every person because it's you're triggering their imagination with black squiggles on a paper, right? And so I think, like, when I have readers in here and they're asking these thoughtful questions that you're talking about, it's because you've touched them in a way, you know, you've entered their own mind in a way, and they've had a unique experience, and they want to know, were they right, or how does that relate to what you did?
Right. It's cute. Like, I have a couple of women in India who, like, they basically told me they had Jake in their mind. They'd imagined what he'd be like and almost didn't want me to in any way interfere with that. It was just a funny moment. I'm like, okay, hang on, you can have him. Like, you know, oh, you're imagining. It was just lovely to think that I had sparked that. And so you make a very good point. There is something very, that I had given all these people some joy and they had enjoyed it. And it had been like, I think that felt very special, and I felt very honored and really grateful, because like you said, it's rare to, you know, it's hard to get it out and get it out to a wide audience. And so you feel such gratitude that, oh, I wrote this and now this is bringing people joy, people are enjoying it, there's discussions around it, you know, and and the nuances that people have picked up on, like, I, you know, there was little lines here and there, and then somebody comes back to me and says, oh, I had an uncle like that. Like, I don't know if you remember, there was an uncle who's a kleptomaniac in this, you know, like, he's stealing from everyone and whatever. He's just a little character. Like, I mentioned him maybe twice in the book, but so many people had like, oh yeah, like in my family, there was this, you know, person who did something straight, but the family would just like, you know, he was held within the family still. And then in certain cultures, how that's not true. And in other cultures, it is like the family is the most important thing, and people will do anything to, you know, like they'll never think of taking him to the police. Doesn't matter what he did. And you know, and that's not true in every situation. So it was interesting to see people's reactions.
So you make a really interesting point there. So you're people around the world who are reading this. So you're, mm-hmm. You're writing for different cultures, and cultures are different, and they have, you know, different broad perceptions, like humor in different cultures is taken in a very different way. So like, let's start with, who is your audience for this? Like, when you are writing this, who is a person, the reader you envision for this? I know you want to go broad and you want everyone to like it, but was there a specific audience in mind?
Yeah. So I was not very ambitious when I started with this. I was sitting at home during COVID writing this, thinking if my daughter, who was at that point, I think she was about 20, she and her friends and our family, you know, if they enjoyed it, that would be very fulfilling. And that's how it started. Like, okay, let me, you know, it was in some ways an homage to the life I lead here. And, you know, and so it was like, okay, this is a way to capture some of this, set it in this world, which I feel like is something that Jeffrey doesn't get written about enough. And that if there's, if I had any sort of why did I write the book kind of thing, I will say part of it was this sense that immigrant literature, there's fabulous immigrant literature out there. So, but it's always stories of loss, of cultures that are, you know, the things you've left behind and that. And I believe that me and many people I know live actually the opposite. We live in a world of abundance, in the sense of we have not one culture, but two, and sometimes maybe more. I know you yourself, like I know your background a little bit. Like, you know, where you're, like, I feel like I came to this country with my Diwali and my Holi, but I've added the Christmas and the Hanukkah without giving up my Diwali and Holi, right? Like, and so it isn't I see my life as one of abundance, of like, two cultures which are so rich and make my world so fabulous. And I wanted to write about that immigrant experience too, because I think that's also true. I'm not saying that the other is not. There's so much of immigrant literature on that, you know, sort of talking about dislocation, of loss. But this one, and of what I'm calling the other immigrant story, I'm so grateful. I really wanted to bring that out. I wanted to, like, I think for my daughter and her friends and all of them, that this would be a story to be told. Like, I wanted readers to also know that, you know, there's a world in which you both assimilate and live really well and yet hold your own original culture strong, and everybody is richer for it. It is a world that is and it exists. It's not one that I'm making up. Like, it exists, and in today's world, like, I think technology really helps make it even more possible, I would say, because when I think back to 30 years ago when I first moved here and was, you know, just calling my mother back home was $1 a minute. You called once in a while. It was like, you know, you wrote those handwritten letters that took 15 days to get there. Email had started, but it was still like my mother didn't really have it. So I still had to handwrite letters. And from that to now on WhatsApp, it's a free call. I mean, some mornings she has me, she's running errands, I'm running errands, things are happening. It's just in the backdrop is my mother on a phone, like doing her stuff. And that's how connected one can be. So, and I feel like that's the stories that don't always get told.
No, I love that. It really, the technology point's really important, right? So it makes the world a lot smaller, but it makes it easier to hold on to your culture. And certainly, like, even family, right? Like, if you're gone for a time, and you, so like many years ago, I travel 150,000 miles a year, and I was in different countries, all 50 countries around the world. And I'd be gone for very long periods of time. And when I come back, the culture would have shifted. But I was so out of it, it was like jarring to me. You know, mm-hmm. I wouldn't understand the cultural references that people were making. You know, like, right. It was very strange. But a lot of that's gone now.
It is. Like my, you know, my nieces and nephews in India, I'm watching the same shows my children are, right? Like, you know, so if you make a, even like an older reference, like a Seinfeld reference, right? When I, like I had to sit down and watch Seinfeld like it was a tutorial because I was feeling so, like when I first moved here, because everybody was referring to this Friends and Seinfeld and I didn't know. And I felt like, you know, I felt, but these kids show up. They not only know what's happening today, but they also know the older shows. They know all these references. The world is so much closer. And it's so wonderful, like, you know, and it's, yeah, it's also easier. So technology definitely makes it, it's possible to have these sort of rich worlds in which you can live in culturally rich worlds that we
are.
You
can make as many Seinfeld references as you'd like here. I love that show. It's relevant all these years later.
That's so
I want to ask you, so as your debut, I mentioned how many people want to write a book. Did this, how long did this, you mentioned it was, you wrote it during COVID. So how long did it take you to write this book from like idea conception, or let's say once you first started, you sat down to start writing?
Yeah. So sat down to start writing right in the middle of COVID. So like that 2020, you know, March, April, when we're all stuck at home, there's no leaving, you know, your groceries are being delivered and you're spraying disinfectants on them. That was the world. That's when I started to write. It took, so then, you know, which was great because I think that I got a lot done in that stretch, you know, and then life came back. There wasn't as much time and it, you know, then there was little bits and pieces. So yes, it took, you know, 4 years for it to come, but that's not, I was not writing the 4 years by any chance. Like, you know, then finding an agent, you know, once you get an agent, then the agent, you know, then you go back and forth with the agent and you do. So it's, and then for the agent to find the publisher. So it's all a long, it takes a while. Like, so anybody writing should know that, you know, you could be lucky, but I think for most people, it's a long journey. And one that I feel like, it's good to have something else happening. You can't sit there waiting every day for someone to respond to you because that's it would be brutal, I think. I'm glad I had other things happening while this, you know. So I would say, if you ask me, I think it's a 2-year journey maybe, but stretched over 4.
Yeah, I mean, the best advice I've heard is like when, as soon as you get something out on submission, immediately start the next thing because it can take years from that point, even when the novel's done. So what you mentioned like this kind of tough time when we were all spraying down surfaces and we didn't know how bad the pandemic was going to get. It was a very dark time. Did the writing of this book give you like a psychological escape? What did it do for you as the writer when you were writing this during a time when everybody was hiding indoors?
Oh, my God. It was such, eventually, so much joy. Not right away. Like right away, actually, my journalism training was a bit of a handicap, I would almost say, because I was trying to be so factual and get everything, you know, like it was like as if there's a fact checker sitting behind me, you know. So it took a little while to let go and let the imagination run. But once I did, you know, so I'm a huge traveler. We were all over the world all the time. And that's a big part of how we live our lives. And so, of course, COVID meant that was all, nothing of that was happening. And I remember sitting in my, literally shackled to my desk in my, you know, and realizing, oh my God, they can go, like Sharmila can be wherever she wants to be. And that's when the whole Barcelona, San Sebastian, I had spent the summer before with my children. I had spent I don't know. It was a month and a half in San Sebastian and I'd loved it. And, you know, sitting there, not being able to move, suddenly thinking, oh my God, she can be there. And I can't tell you, Jeffrey, how much joy that brought. Then I was like looking up the menu at the restaurants I'd eaten. So everything that's there, you know, every dish she eats, every place she goes is real because I was like back there researching it, like, you know, and getting the joy out of researching it, right? Because I could send them off. She was in Barcelona. She was walking down these streets that I had, you know, like, the summer before, but there was no question. And you didn't know at that point, were we ever going to be back doing anything again? What was our world? Like, it was so terrifying at some level. And this was such a wonderful escape. I mean, I really enjoyed that that part of it. Once I sort of let my imagination take over, like, and let the journalist in me sort of take a little bit of a backseat.
It's sort of wish fulfillment, right, on some level.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm interested about the journalism thing. So I've worked with a lot of journalists, and what I often see is in their fiction, they write with a sort of a journalistic style. So it's some exposition, and then punctuate it by a couple a line or two of dialogue, like you would, right? And then yours doesn't read like that at all, right? Yours is way more sophisticated. So you're combining description and action and exposition with inner monologue and dialogue, and you're doing it in a nice balanced way. How long did it take you to make? Because it's a radical shift from journalism. How long did that take?
It definitely was like over a few months. I think the full switch happened. I remember it was like things like, it was really funny. I would have like, okay, she's in Barcelona. Could this conversation happen? And like, I was so like literal in some ways, like was the Basque crisis happening then? No, it's already been. So really it's the Catalan people that we, you know, like this is the journalist in me would have a really hard time mixing up timelines. Like, no, they can't be talking about Basque. They have to talk about Catalan right now because that's what's happening in the world. Or, oh, if she left in the morning from Barcelona, she's going to hit traffic. Like there's, you know, so will it take her 5 hours to Basque country or 7? I would stick to all those facts in a way. And so it took a while to just let go because I think, there was like, you know, years of training in there. But on the upside of that, I would say it made me, I don't think I spend a lot of time giving, and which, again, if you're a great writer, you can do that. But I don't have long descriptions. Like I have descriptions and then the pace, like the story keeps moving. And I think that's, again, the journalist in me that felt the need to keep moving. Like I didn't just sit there and kind of go back and forth and do a lot of, there was a pace to the story, which I think is part of my training that I've got to, you know, the reader's not going to read it till the end if I don't, have things happening continuously. So there is a lot of action and movement through the story.
I'd actually argue that that's a good novelist skill, right? Like you don't want long passages of description. Like that worked maybe in the 1970s, but it doesn't work today. And you are fighting for attention from paragraph to paragraph. Like you really have to hold on to them right from the very beginning. Right. So you mentioned your agent. We have a lot of writers who watch this podcast. Can you tell us a little bit how you went about to get your agent? Because I hear some really weird stories about how people did this, because it's so that agents take about 1 out of every 4,000 queries. You know, a lot of them are getting 100 a day in the slush pile. So it's very difficult to get an agent. So what was your story?
So really, for me, and this is the story of this whole book and everything, I'm somebody who's, I'm very social. I keep in touch with a lot of people. I tend to, and that's helped me in every part of my life. I think from being a happy person with lots of good relationships to also when it came time to, you know, find an agent. Like, yes, I was sending off query letters to everyone, but the woman that I ended up, it came down to two different agents who were interested, and then I went with one. Both of them had, somebody had called them to say, you know, had emailed them, not called, but had emailed them saying, oh, we know this woman who's sending you this. And I think that did help, right? At least they picked it up. Now, would they have taken it if they wanted to? Of course they would. But maybe in those thousands that were showing up, especially post-COVID when so many more people wrote, I have to say I am very grateful for the fact that I basically told everyone that, hey, do you know any agent? Do you know a friend? You know, and so somebody had a friend of a friend who was an agent. And so in both cases, the two women who were interested in representing me both had very distant connections, but at least somebody had sent them a note about me. And I know that's maybe not something others want to hear, but that's the reality, at least in my case, was that both of them had heard about me from someone. But I feel like that's so true. Like even finding you, Jeffrey, like the reason I found you is because I was at an event at the NED where somebody was talking about having gone to one of your salons. And that's how I heard of you. And literally that same evening, a friend had gone for lunch to your restaurant and had seen that there was a book. So I was like, oh my God, how did, you know? So again, this is people talking, friends, like they know I'm interested. I have a book, you know, coming out. So two different people spoke to me about you in the course of like, I think in 24 hours. So I'm like, I have to reach out.
No, so, I think that community is a really big part of it. And because writers write by themselves and they're in their heads and a lot of times they're more introverted than social, you know, mm-hmm. I think that it doesn't sound intuitively like that would be a part of the writing business. But think about it. If you're getting 100 queries a day and then somebody mm-hmm. you know says, oh, you should take a look at this one, at least you know the agent's going to look at it. You know, like a lot of times it's an intern. A lot of times they're just plowing through, not even reading the full query letter, which you can right. understand. So right. how else has community, like this writing community, affected you? Like, I know it's your debut book and you're going out, you're doing your tour now. Did you have beta readers for this?
I did. I mean, my agent was fabulous. She really helped me. Her name is Priya Doraswamy. She's with Lotus Literary. And she's definitely was great. She was feedback right through. My now 24-year-old daughter, but was 20 when it started, is really my most ruthless critic, but also the one who has been fabulous. She has very good instincts. And now when I look back to, like, it's amazing that at 20, she picked up on, you know, a lot of the feedback was so on the point. And in fact, later, when I had the professionals read it, like my agent and then Bloomsbury, some of the things they said was exactly what my 20-year-old had said. So I was like, okay, she might have a career as a literary agent someday, because she definitely knows, you know, what works and where the pacing was and how I needed to change things. So, yeah.
What a huge asset to have that in your family.
Yes, at home, yeah. And during COVID, stuck at home with me. God, she had no choice but to read my stuff and give me feedback.
So when you had the interest from the agents, and like you said, you go back and forth and they're talking about mm-hmm. your book and you're seeing if you're a good match and all that happens. What was it like when you signed? And then tell us a little bit too about going out on submission.
Yeah, I mean, so signing with her was step one. Felt really good. Okay, now I'm this professional. And they just decide, you know, like, they don't make money, as you know, till they sell your book. So just the fact that here's a professional who's willing to, like, that's your first sign that maybe what you have is more than just you and, you know, sitting there and scribbling something. So that felt awesome the first, you know, when I signed that. And then it took, again, longer and then... I think she had thought it would be picked up faster. It took a little longer. So I was like, but, you know, the joy of when Bloomsbury made an offer was amazing. And then, of course, but publishing is a slow business. So, you know, you get the offer and you sit another 9 months go by and you're like, oh, did they forget? Do they realize that, you know, I'm here? So, and then suddenly the pace picks up. And now it's literally like, it's relentless. Like the last 5 weeks, because now that the book's coming out, there's so much to do. And I'm like, you know, but waiting for it was definitely, you know, kind of the moments when I was like, maybe they've forgotten they're doing my book. Like, you know, because there'd be nothing from the publisher for months on end. And then, but then when it starts to come, it's coming so fast at you, you can barely like, okay, you know, approve this, look at this, this is the cover, this is the, you know, and then you realize, oh, acknowledgements have to be written, dedications have to be done, like things that you may, as a first-time writer, I did not know to anticipate. So that'd be like, I'd wake up to like, oh, they need a dedication, you know? And so all those little things were, but you know, it's a fabulous journey and I'm like so excited and I'm very grateful to have it in my life. I feel like here is a second career that's now opened up. I definitely plan to write more. I've already started on my second book, but I see this as the next chapter of my life. And the people you meet, Jeffrey, like, you know, other writers, like just this community that I'm slowly getting to, you know, it's lovely, like to think of like, oh, I could go to, you know, retreats, I could go to literary festivals, like I've just started to apply for those and meet other writers and get, you know, get to what a rich and interesting world that is opening up. Like I'm excited to think of all the opportunities that are out there. So
just being able to meet other writers who go through what you're going through, right? Like no one quite understands unless they've kind of gone through that process. But also like mm-hmm. I've made every mistake known to man as a writer, you know? And so like I can share that with other writers to kind of get them ahead so they don't have to go through that. And
right.
I know when you go to conferences and things like, you know, there's great craft panels and there's, you know, there's all these ways to learn. But often some of the most beneficial moments or information that you'll take out of a conference is like talking over a coffee or something, you know, and just ask asking somebody, hey, I'm having this issue with my agent. What do you think? You know? So I would really encourage you to join the community as much as you can. It's so helpful.
Yeah, no, I need to. I mean, I've just started to like baby steps in that, but I realize there's a whole world out there of, you know, people I can, I guess, make friends with and hang with and, you know, chat with. But also I would love to do like, you know, go on a writer's retreat maybe and just get the next book moving faster because, you know, I don't want another COVID to make this book happen. So want to, you know, but it's hard to take that kind of time out of life.
Mm-hmm. So, like, through this process, I'm asking a lot of questions about the debut because it's so interesting to me, right? Because it really is. Every book feels a little different for people, but that first one, everything is new, right? So you're like, oh, my God. What was, like, the most surprising part of the whole thing, whether it was the writing of the book or some things that were hardest or when you were going through this publishing thing that you're like, wow, what's happening here?
So in the writing part, it was for most part very joyful, but I would say I got to explore a lot of interesting things. So it's not hard as much as interesting. Like I'll say one of the things I got to explore was how as a journalist, because my main character is a journalist, when she becomes the story, you know, how that whole contradiction, like, you know, we as journalists have this like, oh, we're in charge of the narrative. We're relentlessly chasing a story. You get all the facts, you put it down, right? But when you as a journalist realize you're the story, and you know somebody or many, many journalists out there are looking for, you know, looking at you with that, it's a scary feeling because you kind of almost know too much. And I wanted to explore that aside. So that was an interesting kind of naughty thing for me to, you know, like I wanted to get into the weeds on that one as to how when you as a journalist become the story, how that feels. And so that was I'm not saying it was difficult, but it was definitely intriguing and something that I wanted to spend some time on. So that is one thought. You're asking me also what else was surprising. I think the most surprising has been when the book comes out. Like, I really didn't know what. Like, I hadn't spoken to anyone and asked them, hey, what does it feel like when your book comes out? When it's suddenly your friends reading it and friends picking up on things and saying, oh, my God, I can't believe. Or your mother calls to say, I can't believe you wrote about that. Like, you know, in a joyful way, but still like, oh, my, you know. Because you also, when you write, I don't know, you pour yourself into these things, right? You don't realize how vulnerable you're being, how open you're being sometimes. And when others read it and they ask you something and you're like, oh, shoot, I did, you know, and then you're like, yeah, but I did write that. Now I have to talk about it. I can't, you know, they have every right to ask me because I did put it down. But it's interesting. Like, you know, it's I don't know whether it's going to make me write differently the second time around, because now I realize how much of every line you write is scrutinized, is read, is commented on.
I hope you don't change how you write, because honestly, the authenticity that's in the writing and the honesty of the writer, like these characters are not you, they're fictional characters, right? But when you're writing them, they're coming from you, you know? And so you're still, you're envisioning this version of a person. So it's incredibly personal. But if you don't do that, I really think readers don't connect unless they get that level of honesty.
And they definitely got a lot of honesty, Jeffrey, because I seriously, like, it was so character driven. Like, there was no plot line that I was like, you know, it was as they were moving through life is how the story was happening. And you know, and it's a world I know. So the setting was very real and authentic, and the story was very character driven. And so,
So these are the best of both worlds, right? So when you say that, you know, so to what extent was your setting character? To what extent did your setting like drive the mood and the action and the effect on the characters?
You know, the setting is very much two worlds I know well, right? Like the journalism world of DC and like, you know, and that the power and the, you know, because I worked for Forbes, I worked on the Rich List, I worked at Time Magazine's Washington Bureau. So, you know, those things are very real, the world, right? The other world that even less is, it's this high-tech world of that that exists in the DC corridors, right? Like because of the federal government, because of all the many contracts that come out, there's a huge tech community. There's a mini Silicon Valley out here, right? And that world also is something that I know very intimately, both because of family and connections and all of that, but also as when I was writing for Forbes, I used to cover some of this, like this is the early days of the dot-com folks and all of that. So these are worlds that I know well that I based it on, right? So I feel like it's real, authentic, and in some ways a peek into a world that others may not have access to. This very successful Indian American community that lives here. And, you know, and so that was there. And so the characters are driven by the world they live in, right? Like it is, it's ambitious people, hardworking, successful, you know, who really push themselves. And that's the characters in the book, right? Like they, I couldn't really have someone who was like, la-di-da in this because there wasn't like everybody has, you know, has drive and ambition and wants to go places. There's a lot of hunger and ambition to prove. And that's the, it's a very hardworking community. And that's what I, so the characters are to that extent authentic to the setting.
Sorry, so there's like within that setting that you're describing, right? There's personal stakes, there's high stakes, there's a lot of intrigue sort of just built into it. So are you going to continue to write with that framework or are you writing something completely different?
No, I actually, what I realized again from the feedback is that so many people actually would were comparing it to the Crazy Rich Asians book because their point was that that too was not so much of, you know, just the romance, but that whole community that came with it. And he then went on to very successfully write a whole set of books based on those characters. And I, after talking to actually some really well-known writers that I interacted with over the course of the last month, they were all really encouraging me to go with this community. They said, you built something fabulous here and you should explore more of these characters. Like this is an interesting, intriguing world full of very well. And you know, and I wrote up many more characters or backstories than makes it into the book. So it already exists. I have chapters written up about some of the minor characters because initially, as I said, I didn't even think of it as just a romance or one person story. There was all these characters and their stories were sort of moving along. And then sort of Sharmila took over and became the central story and eventually it became her story. And so I really have very well developed like that character of Mark, like someone who, you know, yeah, like has a full on Indian name, but then changes it to Mark and like, you know, and at somewhere in his, you know, teens and 20s wants to be so American and what he thinks of as American, right? And then now, you know, in his 40s, he's meeting this woman who's has a very different idea of how to, what it means to assimilate. And he's questioning her on it and he's intrigued. And then at the end, he says, I hope my daughter grows up to be like you. So clearly, you know, that's his way of saying this is something he admired in the character. So Mark to me is an interesting character. He's flawed, but he's still, I think, very likable. And I think that's true for many of my characters. They're not, there's flaws. There's, you know, they're more nuanced. They don't, I didn't set out with a message. I didn't have a message that I wanted, like, oh, you know, these righteous people get their justified. No, everybody, you know, the way the two men react to a situation without giving too much away, you know, a person coming from the tech world, which is not so hierarchical, which is like you know, it's a startup world. People do their own stuff. You feel like, and the other world, someone coming from a hierarchical world where there is many steps and you don't take on the establishment. You kind of say, okay, the way to survive the establishment is to move with it. And just the way they both approach it is, to me, like, that's nuance. Like, I didn't know which one would appeal to her and what would work for her life, but that they would both come to it with very different points of view is something that is, again, very authentic. Yeah. I mean, I just feel like they are all very real because they are not black and white, that they have like grays. Even Sharmila, like, you know, she's not like this sweet little thing that's like, you know, you're going to love everything. The thing she does, which I'm sure, you know, there will be readers who will be, oh, but they'll also see what's motivating her, how she's growing with it. And I think that's the whole thing. If your characters grow, I think that's, you root for the growth. You may not like everything they do. And so that's, yeah. So I hope, at least so far, it looks like the characters are really resonating with my readership, but I hope that continues.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're real. And I think a lot of these points that you're making about the depth of character and the flaws and character growth, I mean, where did you learn that? Because it's critical, right, in fiction for characters and for people to attach to them. Were there specific books or authors that influenced you that gave you these techniques? Or did you read books on craft? Like, how did you learn that?
So I'm a big reader. I have been my entire life. So I would say I'm not trained in it. So it's not like anyone, you know, but I am a big reader. There are like, if you start, even the first line is a bit of a ode to Jane Austen, like, you know, Pride and Prejudice, where, you know, Mrs. Bennet says like something about whatever, that line about every man with a fortune is looking for a wife kind of thing. And Mrs. Jhunjhunwala saying, you know, you need to do something about this marriage business. So it's like, to me, it's like a little bit of a evoking Jane Austen there. You know, I refer to Hemingway through the book quite a bit, especially in Basque Country. And I'm a huge Hemingway fan. So like, you know, it was fun for me to be able to make those little references to going to Pamplona, to the very cafes in which he sat and wrote, to be in, you know, in that whole world. And the interesting thing, I liked being able to draw that parallel of when Hemingway was also in Basque Country, he sort of, his first wife was back, you know, he had a relationship, he was attracted to someone else when he's there, and how he's, and so I have Sharmila sort of make a point that Hemingway is a great person to, you know, to look up to as a writer, but not his personal life, and like that she should not be. And so those little things were my way of saying these are writers I hugely admire, very different from Jane Austen to Hemingway. But I think reading widely maybe is your best lessons for writing, is that, right? You realize what works, what's interesting. I definitely like to keep my prose lean, and, you know, those are like, you know, because I'm such a fan of Hemingway's, I was always like, you know, I want to keep things clean and clear. So that may be something, you know, there's so many writers I admire. And there's also a huge diaspora, you know, novels written about the diaspora that I read also. So some of those play a role.
So I love those Easter eggs for people who enjoy literature. That's really cool. So I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, you say you're a reader. Like, at what point in your life were you always a reader? Like, when did story first really captivate you? When did you find this magic that I can hear it in the enthusiasm in your voice? You know, when did you first get that connection to story? Do you remember?
Yeah, you know, very young. I remember staying up the night reading something like Gone with the Wind, right? Like, you know, which in India was like, you know, so I grew up in India. So we read a lot of British writers usually. So, and then, so Agatha Christie's and, you know, P.G. Woodhouse's, these were, but then also some of the American writers over the years, like definitely the Fitzgeralds, the Hemingways and all of that. It's always been a source of joy for me from a very young age. I remember when my children were born, one of my big this thing was, I hope they grow up to be readers. And I'm very proud to say that they have, like, there are very often on vacation, all four of us are there, you know, with our books and reading in the same room. And there's something very lovely about reading together. Everybody's reading different things, but just there is. So, yeah, so they're both huge readers. My daughter and I did a few years ago, like, and it's fun to also read together, as in like read around the same topic. We did this deep dive into 1920s Paris. And I can't tell you, if you know, when you pick something like that, then you read everything that's written around it. So, you read Hemingway and you read Fitzgerald wrote at that point, but then you read other people writing about them. You know, there's a book called Paris Wife, which is somebody else has written about a fictional account of Hemingway's first wife. So a journalist went and wrote a book called Everybody Behaves Badly, I remember, which was about the writing of Sun Also Rises and how the stories are so parallel to Hemingway. You know, it's pretty autobiographical, that book of his. And because he's in love with, yeah, it's very interesting. And then I read The Movable Feast. Anyway, So Malaika, my daughter, and I did this deep dive together. And it was so much fun because to your point about the Easter eggs being, you know, like you feel little, oh my God, that's why he said this. And then you'd go back and you'd find the Hemingway reference or, you know, Fitzgerald's writing, I think Tender is the Night at that point. So it's all, you know, so this 1920s Paris was like such a fabulous place to go deep. And I've done this over the years with writing, like, you know, I mean, reading, like treating reading almost like, even though I'm not taking a class, but telling myself, like, if I was taking a class, let's go deep on something.
And, so like, and you mentioned the parallels in Hemingway's life to what he was writing. I mean, mm-hmm. I find that in my own writing later, I'll recognize like themes, not like things right on the nose, but like, mm-hmm. you know, ideas or tensions or things. And Stephen King talks about like doing that and like addiction he had during his life coming out in different ways. Were you aware of any of that in writing this book? Or is that something later you look back and go, oh, some of the character motivations or things that you've been dealing with or mulling over? Did you notice it as you were writing?
No, I did not. And in fact, it took, in some cases, a dear friend or my mother pointing these out to me as they were reading the book in the last few months and saying, oh my God, that's so true. That is so me. And, you know, like I was dealing with that, like, you know. So, yes, it definitely is very joyful to look at, not joyful, but just, to your point, it's like shining a light on your own life, right? And seeing it there. It's a wonderful thing, this writing. I'm so, so grateful to have found it. I feel like I've been given the license, like, you know, how young children have make-believe worlds and they live, and then you become an adult and you never get to play house or teacher or whatever you would, like, you know, these little make-believe things children play, but very quickly that part of life is done. But you know how joyful that is. And I feel like I've been given that license now, right? Like I'm now, you know, I can do this again. I can just create a world, step into it and have things, you know, and cannot say, you know, too much about how much joy this is giving me.
Oh, I love to hear that. And by the way, perfectly said. And that joy that you have in your writing, I hope you never lose that. Sometimes people get caught up in, you know, all the marketing pressures and the business side of it. But in the end, what you're talking about, that joy you have and this imagination that's coming out that you had as a child, that's what draws readers to your writing. You know, like it's there. They want the same thing. We're all readers, right? We all want that same thing. Right. So, oh my God, I absolutely love that. And I hope you never lose that.
Thank you. No, I it struck me one day, this idea that, oh my God, kids get to do it. And as adults, we never do. And now I have a career that allows me to do it. Yay.
There's nothing better. I believe this is coming out on a Tuesday, maybe the 14th, roughly.
Okay.
What do you have coming up? And like, I know you have a bunch of book events coming up. Do you know any off the top of your head?
Yeah. So on the 19th of April, I'm at Politics and Prose. On the 23rd of April, I'm at Wonderland Books. And then on the 30th of April, I'm at Floor in Georgetown, which is a new Argentinian cafe and bookstore. So those three, I'm also in New Orleans at the Garden District Bookstore. So that's on the 27th. So.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun. And where do you want readers to go to find your work? Where would you like them to buy it?
I think Amazon is the easiest option. It's available. And yeah, I would say, please find me on Amazon. It's Heartlines, A Love Triangle. It's a beautiful pink book cover. And it's very, I'm actually really happy with the cover and the jacket that they Bloomsbury came up with. I think it's a very attractive looking book. So
did you have any input in the cover? I know some publishers will give you a choice or they'll ask for your, whether they listen to you or not, right? Did they ask for input or did you have any?
Yeah, they gave me three options. And other two had three characters, like the love triangle, all three. And this one came with just her face. And I have to say, in fact, let me, this is the book cover if anyone can. And I think it is more her story than their story. So I felt like she needed to be on the cover and not the two men. So I was pretty clear. Yeah. So
Since you're holding up that book, I got to ask you, when you, the stories in your imagination and all the time writing and editing and going through your, and going through your agent and the publisher, when you got your box of author copies and you open that up, how did that feel to like physically hold these, this imagination of yours in your hand?
Oh my God. It was amazing. Like, to the authors out there who are listening, that joy. Oh my God, if you could only bundle that up and like bottle it or something. It was an incredible feeling. I have to say, I was very happy with the way it looks. Like, maybe sometimes people are disappointed, but in my case, that was not the story. I really think they did a great job. It's a really attractive looking cover. It conveys what I want, like this, you know, this female, like female-led story. It's very much that. And so I'm glad that they, yeah. It was a lovely, lovely feeling.
It's amazing. You can't replicate it. So I just wanted to ask you, I have one question I do ask all of the authors. Mm-hmm. Where do you think story comes from? And I've heard some very different answers on this one, but you're talking about your imagination. Where do you think like this thing, because you're making something out of whole cloth in a lot of ways, right? And it's a story that hadn't existed in the world. Where do you think it comes from?
Wow. Okay, Jeffrey, that's a really deep question. And I mean, it is obviously imagination, but it is, it's some sort of like the weaving together of things that may have happened in your life, things from your past, you know, stories you've read. Like, you know, for those of us who are big readers, there's, you know, we have our lives and then we have 50,000 other characters that we've read about. So it's some version of all of that. And I think the richness of it comes from maybe the more you've lived. Like, I'm not saying that, you know, I'm sure there's a 20-year-old who has written a fabulous book, but some, to some extent, living a life, a full, rich life, I think gives you that material to make your book, you know, the richness of your book is reflected, at least in my case, for sure, is reflected in the richness of the life I've led. Like, I've lived all over the world. I've like had many, you know, very different experiences. And I think little bits, it's a little line here, it's a line there, it's a little accent there, you know, like something that I've picked up that comes out when you're writing. And that depth is, I think, yeah, with reading, a rich life of the author in some ways does get reflected. So it's a combination of, I would say, pure imagination and experience. And, you know, that's where I would say.
I love that. It's a great answer and really nothing more personal than that.
Right, right.
So what is your website? Where should our readers find you?
It's cghosh.com. So it's literally, so C Chandrani and then Ghosh, G-H-O-S-H, .com. And that's got my, you know, it's got a link to the Amazon and other places. Also, I am going to have a lot more book readings and events, and I'm going to keep those posted so people could come to. I mean, I'm really enjoying meeting people. I didn't realize this was going to be. So now I'm like, up for any amount of book signings and readings, because it gets me in contact with people who are reading. And like you said, writing is a pretty lonely thing. Like, I'm going to go back to my room pretty soon and be, you know, back to my desk and writing. So I feel like I'm going to enjoy the next few months of interacting with the people. And also, like, maybe it'll make the next book richer because I will get all of these experiences now to, you know, add to what already is there. So
it's a very meta concept. Enjoy all the readings. And I always do ask our viewers and listeners, if you're reading this, if you like the book, please go on Amazon and give her a rating. It really helps authors get discovered. This has been a real pleasure. I enjoyed having you on the show, and I'd love you to come by Elaine's Literary Salon sometime. We'd love to have you as part of our writers. Join our writing club.
I would love to. I really would. And I love coming to Alexandria. You're located in a gorgeous part of the country, you know, just by the water there. It's so pretty. So I would love to come. Let's think of a date when I can be there.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.